although there were unique intellectual and academic understandings of the problems of the developing world, Bangladesh, Haiti, all different parts of the globe, I never felt that there was any real management understanding or really understanding the dynamic of the cash flow, of how one decides on asset allocation, et cetera. So
like, for instance, in the case of Oxfam, as chair, you helped transition from what I understand a grants-based organization into, let's say, an advocacy platform.
Exactly.
Right. So can you talk about what that entailed or like why that was so urgent at the time?
We realized in the debt relief process that not only Washington in the sense of institutions, international financial institutions, the IMF, and the desire to have the IMF begin to forgive the debt of the HIPC countries. We recognize that in Washington, because Oxfam America was part of this grassroots, highly regarded international confederation with information coming from very credible grassroots sources, the fact that we were an international confederation and we had 12 countries, many of whom were members of the IMF, but that the American component took no U.S. government money. We all of a sudden recognized the leverage of that unique set of qualities. And it seemed then that we should then begin to campaign domestically because we had a unique voice. We, in fact, had that leverage of having a believable voice. I never understood how cynical the Hill was until that experience, at which point I was really ready to invest in doing that because we had this unique voice. And we got the Clinton administration. Then it was Gene Sperling, who's now back at the White House, and Larry Summers to vote the American shares and we got a bipartisan senatorial commitment as well. The point was, it was because this confederation, this global organization, which we created de novo, had qualities that we as an individual Oxfam America didn't have, and resources we didn't have. The Oxfam UK had resources that, and Novib, Oxfam Novib in the Netherlands, had huge resources of research, campaigning experience along with Australia that we just didn't have to that point. So
in this particular case, although I want to think of it as emblematic of a larger issue,
Basically
the shift towards campaigning and towards advocacy was both necessary, but it was also like a survival or a sustainable kind of move as well.
It wasn't survival, but it was an enabler of this institution. It really began to give life to this new institution. Mm-hmm. The Europeans, who make up most of these global confederations, see Americans as odd ducks. I mean, you know, they see us sort of out for ourselves and not. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have unusual views from our point of view about them, and we have, you know, it's vice versa. So I think in some ways it was a bonding vehicle. The fact that we all agreed and that we spent our political capital, you know, whichever congressmen, senators we could really grab onto in this way to benefit the entire confederation's point of view. Now, the first campaign, the first experience was this almost ad hoc. We then took this model and said, what are we going to do with this? And we created the Make Trade Fair campaign, which was really our first planned. I mean, we had other sort of forays. We did papers on cut the cost, meaning the cost of medicines, which we're still working on today.
You mean like white papers or research
papers? Yeah, we did big research papers.
That are then disseminated within the organization or within the field? Or?
Within the whole field. We presented them at the UN. This was a paper on the cost of medicines, which we all understand a lot better now. But in 2001, nobody understood how the cost of medicines were affecting the developing countries. We did Publish What You Pay, which was really one of the first papers on the corruption mm-hmm. in developing countries where natural resources were being sold by the governments and no one knew how much they were paying. And mm-hmm. and it also involved parts of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act sort of stuff. So we were involved in a lot of these issues, but not as a major global campaign, mm-hmm. but as providing the kind of research we could from our grassroots operations in the field. But the major campaign that we decided to rally around was the Make Trade Fair campaign. And that focused...
And that is now known as Fair Trade.
It is mm-hmm. now known as Fair Trade, but mm-hmm. Fair Trade existed before that. Uh-huh. And Fair Trade at the time was focused on coffee mm-hmm. and tea almost exclusively. The notion here was to look at not just these commodities, but the trade pacts, the general trade agreements mm-hmm. of regions and how they affected the poor countries, helping the developing countries develop their own assemblies, supporting them with computers and telephones and staff so that they could confront the G8 in some organized way rather than being picked off one by one. The whole process, from my point of view, is the practice of giving voice, having the needs of the poor be heard in environments where they are often drowned out by those who have just so much more resource. It was trying to level the field, to provide some economic justice, environmental justice, you know. And it was a natural integration of our product line, if you want to get business school about it. Humanitarian aid is obviously the foundation of our work. We had the humanitarian aid. We had the development practice. Well, giving voice to that practice, all that knowledge and all that understanding as a global institution was the campaigning work. And because the U.S. doesn't take U.S. government money, we had the ability to be...
Oxfam U.S.
Oxfam America doesn't take U.S. government money. Unlike a lot of our partners, mm-hmm. CARE wasn't doing this yet. Mm-hmm. Save the Children wasn't doing it. World Vision, they are huge beneficiaries mm-hmm. of U.S. government money. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've now come to recognize that the foreign aid is seen as U.S. government policy. Yeah. Back 15 years ago, there was a separation that...
So again, it was like, so if I were to extrapolate from that, like within the context of what I do, kind of the selection of particular funding streams or the cultivation of particular funding streams and the, let's say, the turning down or the not seeking out particular funding streams.
Very consciously. We were offered it on a regular basis. Right. While we were in the White House, West Wing, the board meeting, and offered money during, again, saying they'd love to support our work in Africa during the Bush administration. And we said there are lots of organizations who we can suggest you, but for us, this is not the route, you know.
In addition to the work, obviously, at Oxfam, which has been so much at the heart of all of your work, you've also left behind a string of institutions that it seems that you've incubated and then moved on from.
We've helped. I think this, ever since I left the chair of Oxfam in 2005 and the deputy chair of Oxfam International, I really thought that I would not take on a major role. I got sort of into the fair trade because it was a necessity. There was a serious problems. It wasn't something I'd planned to do. But what I really think my contribution has been in the last, you know, is mentoring. How to build a board, how to manage a board, how you manage conflict. I mean, all of these issues to a new NGO leader who's come from, again, being a practitioner in the field, an organizer. These are all new experiences, even though they're terribly bright, terribly knowledgeable. They need the confidence to take some of these steps that resolve conflict and build a strong consensus. And I believe in building strong consensus, and that means you have to confront conflict in an honest, open, inclusive way. It's not always easy because some people just won't engage in that process.
So mentoring would be in and of itself in a way of practice.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm doing. Incubating this source trace system, yes, I've worked on that the last 4 years as the early investor and a board member, but that's providing a technology service to the poor. This is a for-profit company, but it's a social venture. It's a service that is meant almost exclusively for these very rural, poor communities, but it is a for-profit. Because we're still fundraising, no matter how you look at it.
Why was it structured as a for-profit? Was it a tactic in a way?
No, it was structured as a for-profit because the social venture community is a for-profit community. There isn't the same kind of resource, both money and talent, in the not-for-profit arena. You want to be able to incentivize them mm-hmm. in the long run, I guess. I mean, this is the first time we've done this, mm-hmm. But the project was so important, we thought, to our fair trade coffee communities, the cooperatives that are piloting it right now, that we wanted to see if it would work.
So like, what would be a simple description or simple explanation?
Yeah, I mean, coffee cooperatives, some of them have virtually 100,000 members. Little farmers all over Ethiopia, the pilots in Central America and Costa Rica, maybe they have 10,000-12,000 members. Think of, you're giving a receipt to 12,000 members by hand, writing it in a book, traveling out to their coffee farm, picking up their beans, putting them in bags, putting a number on them, bringing it to a sorting station, then a washing station, then a drying station, then putting the coffee back in bags, then weighing it, and then cupping it to see just how good this coffee is and giving it a value. And all this you're doing for 12,000 members of a cooperative, all on maybe a laptop, maybe a PDA device or something. We've created a system that from the time that truck goes out to the farm, they use a system that's attached to the core that literally tracks that bag of coffee so that every farmer has accurate information. And the value to this is just enormous in terms of accuracy, credibility, trust, and financial, because every quality of coffee that's cupped, some get certain premiums, others don't. They weren't able to really identify which coffees got the premiums in a significant way. They'd have to aggregate it so often. So this is very healthy for the co-op world, and it will save them an enormous amount of money. In fact, this one co-op that we're looking at in Central America says that the $70,000-$75,000 a year using our system will cost them, they will get more than that back in premiums because they'll be able to identify the coffees that are better, that Starbucks gives you a 10 or 20% premium for or whatever. So that's exciting, the fact that this is so efficient, saving time, money, as well as increasing their revenue. That was our first reason for doing it, to support the need for more and more farmers to be part of the co-ops. And co-ops were getting to be primary, secondary, and then tertiary co-ops, so that all this data needed to be aggregated in, and creating a fully integrated management information system is something that I feel so, I mean, I believe is why Oxfam grew, because we did that for Oxfam. We wanted to do that for fair trade. In the sense of fair trade, it's not as strong a union, so we needed to do a co-op by co-op. Sort of my practice hasn't changed over the years, what I see and think needs to be done, in the sense of why this investment. It's no different than the time, the intellectual investment we made in Oxfam to really improve the operation so they could run a better ship.
So in the case of that project, STS,
right? Yeah.
So how does a project like that kind of go from a concept derived from learning in the field to kind of a deployed and operational platform? Is it through formal means? Is it through informal means? Is it informal economies? You've spoken.
Yeah, there's some parts of this that are structural, like this social venture network, where you present. One of the first investors came. The social venture network has both individual angels as members, as well as institutions, foundations, or pools of social venture money that's been put together. And they've grown they're 20 years old, they're an institution. So I think they first presented the idea, when we were just getting to know about it, to sort of the screening committee to be in this, or there's investor circle. the screening committee. And one of the members of the screening committee for the investor circle loved the idea and decided to invest himself in it right away and introduced it to a institutional investor in Atlanta, this great Gray Matters Capital, at which point they had two investors. We were already interested. We were like a third or fourth investor. And we all knew, and we knew the primary investor from, he's an Oxfam donor, a fair trade, you know, philanthropist that we knew, who'd done a lot of stuff like this. He'd been in the Grameen phone deal, et cetera. And so we started all talking and put together the first round, which was about, I guess, $800,000 or $900,000, something like that, just to get the systems created, get the platform built, and begin to find clients. And we did. They found a few. Well, we had the demonstration for the coffee project underway. That was all simultaneous. So it, and then the next round was done about a year ago, which raised about $5 million. Because, again, the proof of concept,
it's funder-driven in a way. Or it's funding-driven.
It was funding-driven, but the technology, the scientist here, the computer scientist here, had come from Hewlett-Packard. It had already been tested in Africa. And Hewlett-Packard just did not want to continue this work. Mm. So he had a lot of credibility to the to the original funders who knew a lot. This Gray Matters Capital in Atlanta knew a lot about microfinance and all these institutions that needed this kind of fully integrated management information system. But because they were all rural, there was no way to transmit the data. You know what happens? Just the simple thing. When you're someplace, even in the United States, you're someplace and the data and your phone stops. Well, when you're transmitting financial data and your phone stops, it has to start all over again. This program allows it to seamlessly continue no matter what happens.
Precisely because in a rural area, the interruption of data or power is constant.
Exactly. So he's figured out a way to keep that transmission, either hold on to it or maintain it with very low bandwidth. Now that's the uniqueness of this. Highly encrypted, so nobody can plug into it. This is unique.
So the idea is to to be responsive in a way to real world conditions, which is conditions of load shedding, of power being interrupted, of cell phone communications going down.
Exactly.
Rather than being responsive to an ideal circumstance.
Exactly. Or somebody's telephone, getting unplugged and electricity not being available until they drive someplace else or get a generator going. All the things that can happen.
Right. So it's like the development of very sophisticated technology that can adapt to very rural conditions. And so your role is mentor, advisor, investor. And as an investor, you mean almost as a philanthropist.
The goal, though, is, it's a very risky investment. But the goal here is not to make a big return. We have a cap on the return, which is very modest. The hope is to get back your capital.
It's basically to incubate a social
venture. The goal is to provide the service. Yeah. And we're doing it in Mexico. We have clients in Mexico, in India, Bangladesh.
So the goal is to support projects that are otherwise cash-starved and to enable them to do the work.
And not only cash-starved, but in India we're working with the rural banking system. It's called NABARD. Mm-hmm. Now, NABARD is like 96 banks, and they are the most rural banks. They are quasi-government banks in India. They go out farther into the... And outside of their area, they think there are 600 million people who have no banking services, no way to connect. So NABARD can't afford to build a branch or put an ATM out further into the rural environment. So what we've created is like a mobile teller. With this handheld device, they go out on a schedule, and the little pedicab drivers line up, the little market women, they bank 100 rupees a day, or they take out 100 rupees a day, and they, for the first time, have a smart card in a bank account.
How do you overcome basic issues like trust or distrust, let's say?
Yeah, we're talking about local people who are from the local bank going out to the community. One of the first, I think it was in Nicaragua, a bank there began to use our stuff, people would go and check their card, and if they went to town in an ATM like 20 times a day to be sure the money was, you know, it was all that kind of
the trust
cultural.
Is grown incrementally. It develops incrementally, and it develops through a local trusted kind of.
That's right. That's right. And it gives market women a place to save a dollar or $2 a week. There was no other access for them except a can in the ground until now. So it creates a dynamic for credit. It creates a dynamic for efficiency in microcredit. 80% of microcredit is urban. Only 20% of it gets outside the urban ring into a suburban ring. Almost none of it gets to a rural ring.
Which is still a massive amount of the world's population.
Exactly. So this is a vehicle to allow the efficient way of doing that, too. Now, are we going to find the customers who are going to run good organizations, who are going to pay us on time? We have been fraught with people, well-meaning people, who can't get things accomplished. You know, people who give us a contract, tell us they want to do it, and then just can't ever finish and get it done. We've lost money. Some are working better than others. We haven't turned a profit yet. We haven't been cash positive yet. It takes time. This is all new. And you're relying on not just your own efficiency, but the efficiency of the client that you're hiring. We currently have a contract with a huge telephone company, which is enormously opportunistic. I mean, if it works, because it'll be a channel of distribution to all their rural customers, right? They signed a contract with us, but they cannot get finished the contract they're going to sign with their clients. So we're having to do a contract with their clients ourselves to use our... I mean, you just can't expect what's going to happen. So I think it's been really important to have people like me with, you know, almost 50 years of business experience in lots of different global environments. When something happens, to think through all the possible...
So it's like business acumen in the service of the social good or incubating social good. But so can we actually talk about one other thing?
Sure.
We've talked about this before, your interest and your concern in how you, and I suppose this is a larger conversation that many are having today, in assessing outcomes of development work. Can we talk a bit about that?
It's always been difficult because one environment is so different from another environment. So when Oxfam, in 2004, we began our capital campaign, which was truly was not a capital campaign. It was a $50 million plan to raise $50 million to spend over 5 years to essentially raise our whole level of operation so that we could be raising that much money at the end of that 5 years. I mean, that was kind of a capital campaign. We called it a capital campaign, but it was actually an income development campaign. So in that process, one of the pieces was $4 million to invest in impact evaluation. We'd never had the money to do it really professionally, and that got funded. We actually raised $63 million in that campaign. The other thing, you know, in the humanitarian development world, you get these very, you know, when something terrible happens in the world, you get too much money. When your whole level of operation gets raised and you get 10% overhead on everything, you know how much that can help you build an organization.
I mean, the way you had, if I remember correctly, when we had last had this conversation, you had spoken about how the development community can both be extraordinarily enabling for those in need, and it can sometimes exacerbate or perpetuate or sustain conditions.
We strive to empower independent local organizations. Some organizations that I think put their own boots on the ground, to my mind, it's more of a patronizing environment. And I joined Oxfam because I believe their goal was to teach a man to fish. And when we evolved, a bit more, we said, but we got to figure out who owns the lake. And then when we evolved to the trade campaign, we evolved to, well, who's buying the fish and who's making the profit, you know? We started off with the goal was to teach a man to fish, you know, rather than giving him a fish. And I still think that's the right way to do it. there's sometimes when you can't do that in times of extreme stress. We can't do that in Somalia now. We're feeding, we're doing everything we can to, in the camps in Kenya and in Ethiopia. But getting back to the evaluation process, you know, it's easy when you're feeding people to figure how many people you feed. I mean, in Darfur and the camps, and they were all numbers feeding. And in conjunction with Medecins Sans Frontières and CARE or the Red Cross, we all knew what we were doing. Gets very different when you transition from humanitarian work to development work, and then from development work to campaigning work. So they needed, we really needed professional, new professional practice, and didn't have the money to do that until we raised the money in this campaign. In this last talk we heard about Somalia last few weeks ago, they are really real-time evaluating where they are in terms of their plan, their strategy in the camp in Kenya and in Ethiopia. But the other thing that I think was more interesting is that we've developed indicators that are predicting, so that we can be a, we can communicate with governments earlier that things are happening in environments where we're working. Obviously, we're not working everywhere, but with the 12 Oxfams using a lot, I mean, we're sharing all this data. We're all investing in it. That's the other thing. When you create the global institution, you really are able to cost share on this overhead kind of investment. And that's been very exciting for us. So I think the investment we've made in this work, for example, when the whole microfinance global projects were being financed by Gates, I think it is, we got, of the different organizations they invested in, we got the monitoring piece. We got the evaluation piece because they had evaluated that we had developed more of a capability. Yeah. And that's terrific. So the other organizations, whether they're Save the Children or CARE or whatever, we're in partnership with. Mm-hmm. We all don't have to reinvent the wheel, which to I feel so strongly.
So there was an institutional kind of, let's say, collaboration.
Knowledge sharing. Exactly. See, historically, foundations did an evaluation sort of a year after or 2 years after. And because we are so much better at creating the baseline environment work, we put in place monitoring capabilities as the project begins, as part of the overall, and not just looking at some kind of baseline and some kind of accomplishment a year or two out, which is what historically had been done, is so important. This real-time work is just, I think it's a real evolutionary change. I now know what it's accomplishing. Looking back at 15 years ago, when we were sitting and complaining that we just didn't understand whether we were moving the ball down the field or not, and sometimes I felt like we were pushing a string. You'd go to a board meeting and we still hadn't gotten results back from what we wanted to know because they didn't have the systems. They didn't have the communication systems. I mean, part of this all, I'm sure, has benefited from the information capability that we have today. I mean, I can remember times when we couldn't reach our office in Harare or Mozambique for days, and we had to have armed guards, you know, take people in. And I mean, all that, you know, today, as I said, we used to hire, even 2002, I had to rent a satellite phone when I went to Ethiopia. I'm sure all of these things we've wanted to do are completely made more do, you know, more possible by the communications and that's, you know, so that's, I think, a real benefit of some of this quick evolving technology. And of course the whole campaigning capability. You know, we used to live by direct mail, which was so expensive. I think Oxfam America has 300,000 or 400,000 donors. We have something like 500,000 activists. And so we literally had to create the systems to teach everybody how to keep track of what was real grassroots lobbying and accountable and what wasn't, everybody from the president down to a secretary. And then we created the C4 so we could raise independent money for that work and really protect our core. And that's been a big success because we've been raising between $800 and $1 million a year for our campaigning work from all those activists. Little bits, but we could never even afford to do, take all those little $10 gifts if it wasn't for the internet, if it wasn't for Facebook and Twitter and putting together all of these communities on all these issues. We spent $1 million in 2004 to create a fully integrated management information and contribution system. It got done October before the tsunami. In the tsunami, we had 350,000 donors. We would never have been able to capture those names if we hadn't made the kind of investments we needed to make. They may not be donors today, but they may well be part of our activist community. I mean,
so it's a very complex and rigorous investment in platforms that enable
absolutely
within the organization and more generally within the public possibilities.
Yeah, and we knew that we had these big calamities. I mean, big famines with lots of money coming in, but we'd never been able to have the resources to capture the data. Mm-hmm. And even if we captured it, we were never able to access it in. Direct mail is so terribly expensive. Uh-huh. We could never mail to people who'd never given us mm-hmm. money in 2 or 3 years without an enormous risk. But being able to capture it all electronically it made a big difference in our mm-hmm. campaigning capability.
But you're anticipating future growth.
Absolutely.
Rather than investing in the reverse.
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
without this reserve that we started building in 92, I mean, there's no question that if I made a contribution, it was demanding that we
have capital reserves.
That we save 1% and that we invest it. And any money we didn't spend budget would go into the reserve. Uh-huh. We then built a reserve of essentially, the goal was 6 months of our budget. Uh-huh. And we have more than that now. So when the downturn comes, we didn't have to lay anybody off at Oxfam.
Why not? I mean, I understand the importance of capital reserves, but why not further grow one's programs?
You know, I think you have to have measured growth. Uh-huh. I think, we have, from the time I joined the board in 92 to today, we've had, I think it was like $8 million. I think we're at 65 or 70. We have had really well-managed growth, and it's exciting. But I think the core is so well-managed now and so well, it's basically pretty secure, unlike the past.
So it's both anticipating future need, anticipating future growth, but also managing that growth so that one can manage one's ability to meet those needs.
Right. I mean, having only 6 months of cash is not a lot of cash, given something. I mean, look, when we had the huge downturn, we had to use some of it. But that's what it was there for. Uh-huh. That was the reason it was there, to manage, a downturn when the markets went crazy and people didn't make the end of year gifts or at the level of gifts they used to give. This is a business. It's a hard business.
Meaning philanthropy is a business, or you mean development work?
Development is a business because you're dealing with every need of any global company. Every infrastructure need, everything from computer systems and, IT and transportation and all of those issues that need to be budgeted for and managed. And and a bad IT system can seriously harm an NGO, just like it can a shoe manufacturing company. I think to be consistent and successful and to be able to grow in a consistent way, if the need diminished, sometimes some environments that we work in, the need diminishes. It's all relative, of course. But we closed our office in South Africa and opened one, bigger one, in Darfur and Ethiopia. Our office in Phnom Penh is different in terms of what it's doing. We've changed, we've moved around a little bit, and the different Oxfams are trying very hard not to overlap one another. We finally evolved. The whole basis for the global organization was to not have 5 Oxfams on the high street in Phnom Penh or 7 sometimes. So the flexibility of having a global network is a good thing. Confederation has really been very important, very important.